At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Okay, fire up the global economic spotlight for me. Shine it on Davos, Switzerland.
America is open for business, and we are competitive once again.
So let's talk about that, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl, 26th of January, today, Friday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This has been, an interesting week economy-wise, the global one and the American one. So much to talk about, only 5 minutes of live radio in which to do it. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Rachel Abrams is at the New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hey there.
Hey, Kai.
So, Rachel, let me go to you first and ask you just for your sense of the president's speech today at the World Economic Forum up in Davos. What'd you think?
I mean, I really was left wondering what is the point of this speech, because obviously the point is to show that America's open for business, to show mm-hmm. the broader community that they should come here, they should invest here, that it's it. But all you have to do is look at what Trump has done since taking office. He has promoted a strictly nationalist America First agenda. He's ripped up trade agreements. We're in the middle of trying to curb the flow of immigration, including right. legal immigration, which the business community is staunchly against. And even he just imposed a tariff on washing machines and solar panels earlier mm-hmm. this week. So, I mean, if he's telling people we're open for business, we're sort of interested in, we could potentially be interested in TPP again or on better terms. I mean, all you have to do is look at what he's done and what right. he said. So I'm just not sure what the effect of this one speech would have on these folks.
Okay, so let's get to the TPP for a second. Lynette, I'm going to play a piece of tape. Here's the president. He says, leading into this piece of tape, he says, I really want bilateral trade deals, but also we could do this. And here he is.
This will include the countries in TPP, which are very important. We have agreements with several of them already. We would consider negotiating with the rest, either individually or perhaps as a group, if it is in the interests of all.
Okay, so the president pulled us out of the TPP. Not only that, this week, the TPP nations, the 11 of them, Lynette, came to an agreement that they will sign next month in Chile, I believe. Why would anybody get into a bilateral or even a multilateral trading relationship when the president is talking about pulling up the borders?
Again, good question. But clearly Trump's,
okay.
you know, but Trump is clearly thinking about China here. He ripped up TPP a little too hastily. Now we see him trying to negotiate with China about North Korea. We see that China and Trump's administration on the economic front are again coming head to head. As Rachel mentioned, washing machines, solar panels. This TPP deal was supposed to be another measure that was going to bring the U.S. and the rest of Asia against China. And Trump obviously had no idea about any of that when he took office. Come on.
Let me just, Rachel, really quickly turn to China again and hearken back to President Xi Jinping's speech from last year, where he came out and he said, China is open to the world. We are ready to step up and take our place in the global economy, as a contrast to what the president said today.
Yeah, I think that was sort of the biggest sort of take away if you did compare the two? President Trump, while he did sort of tamp down some of the nationalism that he has promoted in previous speeches, it was very much about America first, maybe not America alone, as he said, but certainly America first, and really, you know, emphasizing that America is only going to do deals that are good for America.
I have a gripe with the China thing, though.
All right, quick.
My gripe is that everyone's saying Xi Jinping is a freer, more open, blah, blah, blah. But that was just rhetoric. The Chinese economy is in many, many ways more closed now than it was when Xi Jinping's predecessors were in office.
That is totally fair.
It's far more managed. So what China is really trying to do is take this moment as a PR move to say, now we are the leaders of free market economies. And we are the leaders of that vanguard.
Right.
And the United States is stepping down.
And it worked last year, right? Everybody came out of Davos and said, wow, what a speech by Xi Jinping, right? That's what
And
they
he's
said.
Not here this year.
That is true. All right. So a couple other things to talk about. Only a minute and a half left. Rachel, really quickly, the GDP report from this morning, 2.3% on an annualized basis. We're going to talk about it in a minute with Mitchell Hartman. I want to point out, though, that it is well shy of what the president and the White House have been promising, and it's going to be tough to get it up to the 3 or 4 or 5% that the White House wants us to get to.
Yeah, but Kai, you and I have been saying this, I feel like, on every show since he took office, is how unrealistic 3% or even above is. I mean, at this point, it shouldn't be a surprise that 2.6%, which is how the economy grew in the fourth quarter last year, like, at this point, I feel like a broken record. You know, it's very...
But you gotta say it.
No, of course. But I only mean it in the sense of, like, it's no surprise at this point that despite the fact that it is totally unrealistic, he's going to keep pushing it until, I don't know, maybe he realizes it's not.
And serious people are going to keep saying no.
Exactly. All right, Lynette, last word goes to you, and it's going to have to be sadly brief because I know you got a lot to say on this. Stephen Mnuchin, and talking about the weak dollar, how the Americans want a weak dollar for trade. The president tried to walk it back, and the markets just looked at the two of them and said, yeah, whatever, we're still selling.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those do as I do, not as I say moments. Or Wall Street was basically looking at what Mnuchin and Trump are doing, not what they're saying. You know, part of the reason why the dollar is selling off is because people are concerned about trade issues. They are concerned about Trump policy going forward. And the tax bill isn't actually going to repatriate that much money back on shore as people thought.
Right.
So there's a ton of reasons to be skeptical about what the administration says. And the administration is known for not having a familiarity with the truth. You kind of just got to watch what they do.
Let's remember that the president of the United States called Michael Flynn in the middle of the night to ask about dollar policy way back in the beginning. Remember that one? Lynette Lopez at Business Insider and Rachel Abrams at the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street Today, I'll tell you what. I'm going to give you a number. You guess what it means, and then I'll give you the answer, all right? Here you go. So the number is 6547, 6,547. Does that ring a bell? Anybody? That is where the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at the low of the financial crisis, March of 2009. I'm telling you that because today this became, with the close of the Dow, a 20,000-point economic recovery. What does that mean, big picture, 20,000 points? Yeah, too terribly much. The Dow is not the economy and all that. I did think. It was interesting, though, just as a milestone. Green all the way around in equities. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So as Rachel and Lynette and I were talking about, we got the fourth quarter gross domestic product report today, 2.6% on an annualized basis, October through December. And through all of 2017, the economy was growing at a rate of 2.3%. Solid and a nice bump from 2016, but well shy, as Rachel pointed out, of what the White House had been promising, 3, 4, 5, he even said 6 or 7% in Davos this week. But expectations and promises aside, there were some real signs of economic strength in today's numbers, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Dig down into the components of economic growth, and the story is better than a 2.6% quarterly GDP increase suggests, says Joe Bruzuelas at consulting firm RSM. Demand for goods and services, exports, residential construction were all up significantly.
We have a very strong domestic expansion occurring. American consumers are spending at the strongest pace we've seen in a number of years. Private businesses are beginning to improve capital expenditures.
He says they're buying new equipment to make their factories, offices, and workers more productive. Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics says in the short term, growth is likely to improve.
For two key reasons. One, the deficit finance tax cut. So the government's going to go out and borrow money and give everyone a tax cut, and we'll see increased spending and economic activity. And the other reason is a better global economy,
which will likely boost U.S. exports and maybe also U.S. manufacturing to supply them. But, says Zandi,
I don't think long-term underlying growth has changed. It's just a spurt of growth this year.
Americans still aren't seeing big increases in pay, the savings rate is down, and we've been financing our recent shopping spree largely with debt. Zandi says that could eventually lead consumers to cut back on spending. And he predicts all that, plus higher interest rates, could pull economic growth back into the low 2% range. That's the long-term trend for the economy since the end of the Great Recession. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The stage is being set for something of a fight over net neutrality, the idea rejected by the Federal Communications Commission last month that internet service providers can't throttle or otherwise favor certain kinds of content over others, that they got to be neutral, hence the name. That is the federal rule now. States, however, have other ideas about this. The governors of Montana and New York have signed executive orders to mandate net neutrality under their jurisdictions, and 21 states and the District of Columbia have sued to overturn the decision by FCC Chairman Ajit Pai. Marketplace's Ryan Kailoff has the details.
So here's what Montana and New York are doing. They're saying, okay, net neutrality has been repealed at the federal level. We're going to preserve it for our states by making the internet service providers an offer they can't refuse. The executive orders signed this week say that any ISP that wants a state contract to provide internet for state offices or public schools or whatnot, if they want that contract, they'll have to preserve net neutrality. Or the state will take its business elsewhere. Ernesto Falcone of the Electronic Frontier Foundation says the FCC saw this coming and already told states they can't pull tricks like this. But
I think the FCC lacks authority to do that.
The irony, Falcone says, is that part of the FCC's whole argument for repealing net neutrality is that states should be able to make their own rules.
If you get rid of all the federal laws that apply to you, you also free up the states to do what they want.
He says the ISPs could sue, arguing the state is limiting their business. But former FCC chief enforcer Travis LeBlanc, now with law firm Boies Schiller Flexner, says they aren't likely to win.
Because no company is required to do business with the government.
Because these are executive orders and not laws, says LeBlanc, the state isn't legally imposing anything on the ISPs. It's merely setting up a condition for doing business, which is hard to challenge in court. For that reason, he thinks
net neutrality is likely to be with us for the future, at least in New York and Montana.
In New York, I'm Ryan Kailoff for Marketplace.
It's been almost 3 weeks since heavy rains here in Southern California triggered those mudslides in the hills above Montecito in Santa Barbara County. More than 20 people were killed after a mix of mud, boulders, and trees came sliding down hillsides that had been burned in the wildfires last month. Hundreds of government workers and contractors have been hauling debris out around the clock. It took them nearly 2 weeks just to get the main north-south highway up there, Highway 101, open. So really, the cleanup has just barely begun, as Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Most call it a mudslide, but John Fry wants people to understand it's a lot more than just mud. He prefers the technical term, a debris flow.
It's almost like a wet concrete-type mixture that can end up moving and floating rock the size of a school bus. It'll take out anything in its way, and that's what happened up here.
Officer, I'm with flood control. Can I get through, please?
He drives me to some of the hardest-hit areas, and we see hillside homes flattened by fast-moving boulders and thick trees uprooted everywhere. The public isn't allowed here, but Fry's an engineer with Santa Barbara County Flood Control.
You can see that gas line. It's bent like a piece of spaghetti right there. To the left were several homes that are no longer there.
Just a swimming pool filled with debris. Fry keeps his truck's hazards on as emergency crews and dump trucks work the hillside. Some haul rock out of debris basins, massive pits built to catch whatever falls from the mountains above. They were quickly overwhelmed by the storms.
This basin was completely filled. In fact, it was like 125% filled with this rocky,
material that we're looking at here.
Some boulders are so large that excavators with hydraulic hammers have to break them into pieces before they're scooped into dump trucks and hauled 50 miles away. FEMA and the Army Corps have awarded more than $24 million in private contracts for this work. Cleaning the basins is a priority.
We don't know when the next storm is going to come in. We need these basins and channels back to their pre-storm condition.
The basin cleanup alone is far from done. The 24-hour merry-go-round of dump trucks will continue at least through the end of February. And this is just one of several fronts in the effort. The normal rhythm of work and life and the tourist economy won't return until it's all done. Officials struggle with where to put all the rock and muck, mixed with car parts, raw sewage, and contents of homes. Some gets hauled to the beach. There's no swimming at Goleta Beach because of bacteria in the mud dumped there. Bulldozers push piles of brown dirt out into the surf.
Every day, through one tide cycle, it's all mixed in, and the next morning it looks like the regular beach again.
That's County Environmental Planner Seth Shank. From behind an orange safety fence, he tells curious onlookers this is necessary. There's already more debris than anyone knows what to do with, and cleanup crews haven't even started on private property.
Which is a big, big, big deal. They say that basically 90% of the material is on private property, and so there is a huge volume of material still out there that's going to have to be dealt with.
Many residents haven't even seen their homes since they escaped the disaster. Here's a video shot by realtor Marco Farrell the morning his family evacuated.
Turn around! The flash flood's right there! The flash flood's right there! Get out of here! Go!
You see a wall of trees and mud advancing down the mountain at speeds of more than 30 miles an hour. He and his parents got rescued after standing for hours in knee-deep mud. The Farrells have been staying at a friend's house. Their neighborhood is still closed off.
It's a weird, twisted staycation where we're just kind of fiddling our fingers, waiting to get in to try to save our stuff as it slowly rots away.
Cleaning up is too complicated and dangerous for families to do themselves. Thick layers of dried mud can be hard as brick. Some homeowners want to hire private mud haulers now, but authorities don't want the extra traffic and safety risk. Farrell understands the concern. Not far from his home, debris crews are still joined by forensic experts who stand by and look for the bodies of the missing among the rubble.
We're the lucky ones. You know, some people don't have a home. Some people don't have family to go back to.
Farrell reminds himself to be patient, but he's eager for answers from his insurance company, for one. Mudslides technically fall under flood insurance, which he and most Montecito residents didn't have. Because the debris flow was caused by the fires, homeowners' policies should cover the damage, but insurers are the ones to decide. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Coming up.
That varies from place to place and state to state, but generally it costs several hundred dollars.
You want to learn how to drive? Yeah, it's going to cost you. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 223 points today, 0.8%, finished at 26,616. That is 20,000 points the past nine some odd years. NASDAQ gained 9 points today, about 1.25%, 7,505. S&P 500 up 33, 1.1%, 28.72. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow grew 2%, the NASDAQ 2.3%, the S&P 500 2.2%. Chip makers crunched higher. Intel buzzed up 10.5% today. Fourth quarter beat analyst expectations. Micron Technology moved up about 1.5%. Boeing rose less than 0.1%. The U.S. International Trade Commission ruled this aircraft maker wasn't harmed by competition from Canadian rival Bombardier. This effectively scuppers, good word, scuppers. Commerce Department plans to impose hefty tariffs on Bombardier's planes. Bombardier up 15.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're doing a project all this year about the financial crisis. Well, not the crisis itself so much, but how the near cratering of the American economy 10 years ago and the recession that followed changed this country. It changed things, big picture, yes. It also changed things day to day, how people feel about their personal economies and their futures. And we've been asking those folks to tell us their stories. Today from Los Angeles, Jason Friedman.
In 2007, I bought my first house with my wife. And as a financial planner, I wanted to make sure that wherever I bought a house, it was going to be someplace that I could be for a while. So the house that we ended up buying was a nice little four-bedroom house in a good neighborhood across the street from an elementary school that we were excited to, you know, have a family and the kids could go to that elementary school. But what I didn't expect is I didn't expect to get a divorce a year later. I ended up keeping the house and my wife moved out. I didn't want to sell the house for a couple of reasons. One is it was so far below what I paid for it in 2007 that I didn't want to short sell it and I didn't want to foreclose on it, primarily because that was going to affect me professionally. It was a time where I had empty rooms in my house and an empty refrigerator and an empty bank account. And when you open up my pantry, it would pretty much just be a few cans of tuna. And it was pretty bare bones, and it was tough. But I felt that as long as I can make that mortgage payment, I would be able to keep the house long enough for the recovery, and I just had to weather the storm long enough. I think that the financial crisis humbled me in many ways. One is that I knew that to always plan for the unexpected, but what I realized during the recession is that you can't plan for the unexpected because you don't know what that unexpected is going to be. And although that I planned for the recession, I didn't plan for the divorce. In my profession, I'm able to talk to people about their finances and know how they're doing. For some people, it's still kind of fresh in their minds. You know, for other people, they feel that we're completely out of the woods and don't think that it can happen again. And it absolutely will happen again.
It will happen again. We've got some pictures of Jason on our Instagram. It's at MarketplaceAPM. The hashtag we're using for our project, Divide a Decade, is How We Change. We'd love for you to post your story. Economic forces are sometimes unseen. Other times they are just forgotten about. Here's one that's kind of both. Driver's ed that most states require of their would-be teenage drivers before they can get their licenses. Driver's ed used to happen in public schools, free of upfront charges. Not so much anymore. Kathy Valli wrote about this in Pacific Standard. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me.
What happened that schools are now no longer doing driver's ed as part of their programs?
Well, some restructuring and defunding happened. In my piece, I talked about Michigan, which is my home state. Mm-hmm. Back in 2004, the state defunded and restructured their program. It used to be that driver's ed was funded through the public school system. Yeah. And that's pretty much no longer the case across the country anymore.
So if you're a 15 or 16-year-old, depending on what state you're in, how much is it going to cost you, or more accurately, probably, your parents to get driver's ed out on the market?
That varies from place to place and state to state, but generally, it costs several hundred dollars. So in my community, it's about $300 as an upfront cost. And then there's, you know, just additional fees plus another, there's segment two that you have to take later on that costs additional money. So by the time you roll it all together, it's around $500.
All right, that's not nothing.
No, it sure isn't.
And then you have kids who 16, 17 years old, some of them use cars to get to jobs and all that. I mean, it has kind of a trickle-down effect, if I could coin an economic phrase here.
Well, for sure. It's kind of an example of the structural inequality that we see along racial and socioeconomic lines. And this is an interesting place where we see this because it's sort of creates that structural inequality for young adults right as they're starting to enter the job market, maybe get their first jobs, wanting to go out with friends, even, you know, social things that makes the isolation compounded.
Right. And let me back you up for a minute. The socioeconomic bit of this is that it's mostly low-income families and families of color who probably can't afford this $500 to get their kid behind the wheel, right?
That's right.
And so what are the solutions? I mean, you write that some states are providing financial aid to some of these folks to be able to maybe get them part of the way there?
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing is there are potential solutions. It's just that a lot of places aren't implementing them. So we found that in Georgia, that's the example that I think you're citing, is the state of Georgia has a scholarship program that's offered through the state. That scholarship program, interestingly, is funded through a 1% surcharge on traffic citations in the state. And so that program started being implemented last March. And between March and when I was doing the reporting, they had already offered around 9,000 scholarships to students in their state, which is a significant impact.
Yeah, and I wonder 9,000 out of how many, though?
Right, it's true. I mean, it's still not, you know, a giant percentage, right, but it's much, much more significant than, say, what we're seeing in Michigan.
Huh. Kathy Valle writing on Driver's Ed, who gets it, who doesn't, and how it costs so much in Pacific Standard. Kathy, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, I finally caught up with the most recent episode of This Is Us last night. And let me just say, I'm not crying. You're crying. Anyway, seeing as how the informal but universally accepted 72-hour spoiler window is just about to expire, this item, Crockpot, is not taking its fictional culpability lying down. The company took to Twitter to defend itself with this quote: "Since the 1970s, we've been providing families with quality and safe products. Ask your parents if you don't believe us. DM us with any questions. We'd be happy to tell you more about our safety standards." So there is that. Also, series creator Dan Fogelman, who we've had on this show, by the way, he tweeted this: "Taking a moment to remind everybody that it was a 20-year-old fictional crockpot with an already funky switch. Let's not just lump all those lovely, hardworking crockpots together." My interview with Dan, minus any crockpot references, of course, is at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 223 today, 0.8%. NASDAQ up 94, about 1.25%. S&P 500 put on 33 points, 1.1% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Our executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Evelyn LaRubia is the executive editor. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a good weekend, everybody. We will see you on Monday, all right? This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.